Welcome back to The Deep Dive. Today, we're going to do something a little different. I want you to picture yourself sitting in a window seat maybe 30,000 feet over the Atlantic. You look out at the wing at that massive jet engine. Inside that casing, there are turbine blades spinning at thousands of RPMs, and they're subjected to temperatures, well, temperatures that are hotter than the melting point of the metal they're made of.
It's a bit of a logical paradox, isn't it? The air around the blade is hot enough to literally melt it, and yet the blade survives.
Exactly. And the reason you stay in the air and not in the ocean, it comes down to a very specific, very high-stakes recipe. Today, we're looking at the single crystal superalloy. Specifically, we're unpacking a classic paper. It's from 1984 by G.S. Hillier and H.K.D.H. Padishia from the University of Cambridge, and it's titled Homogenization of Single Crystal Superalloys.
And, you know, while that title sounds pretty dry, this paper is actually about the manufacturing equivalent of walking a tightrope. Mm-hmm. It's about how you take this messy piece of cast metal and cook it to perfection without destroying it in the process.
The stakes are incredibly high here. We aren't just talking about making a slightly better toaster. If you get this process wrong, the engine fails. So our mission today is to understand homogenization. We need to figure out why these superalloys start out as this kind of chemical disaster, how we use heat to fix them, and how one specific element, titanium, makes the whole process a total nightmare.
It's a classic case of an engineering trade-off. Titanium gives you strength, but it fights you every single step of the way during manufacturing.
Before we get to the fight, let's establish the battlefield. We're talking about single crystal blades. I think for most people, metal is just metal, you know, a solid block. But that's not really true, is it?
No, not at all. If you look at the steel in your car or the aluminum in a soda can under a microscope, it looks like a mosaic. It's polycrystalline. It's made up of millions of tiny grains all jammed together. And where those grains touch, you have borders. We call them grain boundaries.
And in the context of a jet engine, those borders are the enemy.
They're the weak link. Absolutely. Under high heat and stress, those grains can actually slide past each other along the boundaries. It's a phenomenon called creep. The blade physically stretches over time. If it stretches too much, it hits the engine casing, and, well, you have a catastrophic failure.
So the solution seems almost obvious. Just get rid of the boundaries. Make the entire blade out of one single continuous crystal.
Exactly. That's the single crystal revolution. No boundaries, no sliding, much higher heat resistance. But here's the nuance that Hillier and Padishia really tackle. Just because it's one crystal structurally, that doesn't mean it's uniform chemically.
Right, and this is the part that surprised me. You'd think a single crystal would be perfect, but the paper describes the ass-cast structure, so the metal right after it cools from liquid is basically a mess.
It is a mess. You have to remember, this isn't pure gold we're talking about. It's a superalloy. It's a soup of nickel, aluminum, titanium, tungsten, tantalum, chromium, and they just don't all behave the same way when they freeze.
The paper uses the term dendritic structure. That comes from the Greek for tree, right?
Yes, and it's a great visual. Imagine a forest of microscopic fir trees made of solid metal growing out of the liquid soup. As the metal cools, these trees, the dendrites, they form first. But they're picky eaters. The solid crystal prefers certain heavy, high melting point elements.
Like tungsten?
Correct. The core of that tree trunk, it grabs the tungsten. But it rejects other elements, pushing them out into the remaining liquid that's surrounding the tree.
So the tungsten is hogging the center, and it's pushing the aluminum and the titanium out into the gaps between the branches.
Precisely. They get pushed into what we call the interdendritic regions. So chemically, you've got a checkerboard. Tungsten-rich cores and aluminum and titanium-rich edges.
And since that liquid at the edges eventually has to freeze too, what happens to it? It's just chock full of all the rejected ingredients.
It forms a completely different structure. Mm. The paper identifies this as a coarse gamma-gamma prime eutectic.
I was looking at figure 3 in the source material, and honestly, coarse eutectic just looks like chunky blobs sitting in the metal.
That's a pretty fair description.
Yep.
It's a brittle phase. It's a mixture that freezes at a lower temperature. If you tried to put that blade into an engine immediately after casting, those chunky blobs would be massive weak points. They'd just melt or crack under surface conditions.
Okay, so we have a single crystal, but it's full of chemical segregation, these tree rings of tungsten, blobs of brittle eutectic. This brings us to the core topic, homogenization. We have to clean up the mess.
We have to hit the reset button. We need to take this segregated structure and redistribute the atoms evenly. And really, the only way to move atoms in a solid is heat.
Heat is energy. It gets them wiggling.
Right. We need to heat the blade up so that diffusion kicks in. We want the tungsten to migrate out of the cores and the aluminum and titanium to migrate back in until the composition is, you know, flat.
But, and this is kind of the thriller part of the paper, you can't just set the oven to high. Mm-hmm. We are dealing with a very specific heat treatment window.
This is the critical concept. You're basically operating between a floor and a ceiling.
Okay, let's define the floor first. The paper calls it the gamma prime solvus.
Think of the floor as the minimum requirement, those chunky eutectic blobs we talked about. They're stable at lower temperatures. So to get rid of them, to dissolve them back into the matrix, you have to heat the metal above a certain point. That's the solvus. If you're below the floor, the chunks stay chunky and the part is defective.
Okay, so you have to go high enough to dissolve the bad stuff. What's the ceiling?
The ceiling is the incipient melting point, or the solidus. This is the temperature where the metal actually starts to melt.
But wait, if we're making turbine blades, don't we want them to resist melting?
We do, but you have to remember those segregated pockets, the titanium-rich areas in the gaps between the dendrites. They have a lower melting point than the rest of the blade. If you heat the oven just a few degrees too high, those pockets turn into liquid.
And if they turn to liquid inside the solid blade?
You've destroyed the single crystal structure. You get porosity. You get new grain boundaries forming when it refreezes. The part is scrap. Useless.
So the window is the safety cap. You have to be hot enough to dissolve the eutectic, which is the floor, but cool enough not to melt the pockets, the ceiling.
Ideally, you want a wide window. You want to be able to set your furnace to, say, 1300 degrees C and know you have a plus or minus 50 degree buffer.
But this is where the paper introduces the antagonist of our story, titanium. The researchers didn't just test one alloy. They tested seven, and they're labeled alloy A through alloy G.
Now, the main thing they varied was the titanium content. Alloy A was on the low end, about 1.8 atomic percent. Alloy G was high, about 2.7%.
Why mess with the titanium levels at all? I mean, why not just stick to the easy recipe?
Because titanium is a strengthener. It helps form the gamma prime phase that makes the alloy tough. Engineers always want to push the titanium up to get better performance out of the blade.
So they want more titanium for strength, but what the paper shows is that titanium just wrecks the heat treatment window.
I'm looking at the graph in figure two. It looks like a pincer movement.
It is exactly a pincer movement. So look at the ceiling first, the melting point. As you add more titanium, the melting point of the alloy drops. Titanium actually suppresses the solidus temperature, so the ceiling is coming down on top of you.
And the floor. The temperature you need to dissolve those chunky blobs.
That goes up. Adding titanium makes those eutectic chunks more stable. You need more heat to break them down.
So the ceiling is dropping and the floor is rising. The room's getting smaller and smaller.
Much smaller. In the low titanium alloys, you might have a comfortable, say, 80 degree window. But as you get to alloy G, the high titanium version, that window shrinks to maybe 10 or 20 degrees.
That is terrifying for a manufacturer. Mm. Maintaining a massive industrial furnace within a 10 degree variance at 1300 degrees Celsius seems ambitious. It's incredibly difficult. And Hillier and Badacia point out a secondary problem. It's not just that the window is tighter. It's that the job itself is harder.
How so?
High titanium doesn't just change the temperatures. It increases the volume of the mess. There's physically more eutectic mixture to dissolve in alloy G than there is in alloy A.
So you have a narrower temperature range to work in. A and D, you have more garbage to clean up.
Which means you need more time.
Yeah.
Diffusion is slow. So to dissolve a big pile of eutectic, you need to hold the metal at that high temperature for longer. But holding a part that is on the verge of melting for 60 hours greatly increases the risk of an oven spike ruining the whole batch.
It's like trying to cook a massive turkey, but you're only allowed to set the oven to a temperature that is 1 degree below burning the house down, and you have to keep it there for 3 days.
That is a very vivid but a pretty accurate analogy.
But they did it. They cooked these crystals at 1300 degrees C for up to 64 hours. And this leads to the part of the paper that I found really chemically interesting, the theory versus reality section.
Yes, this is where the science gets fascinating. They tried to predict how long the homogenization would take using a standard mathematical model.
The sinusoidal relaxation time formula. So T equals D2D dollar.
Right. It looks complicated, but it's just a standard diffusion equation. Mm. D is the distance the atoms have to travel, basically the spacing between the dendrite trees. And D is the diffusivity, the speed limit of the atoms moving through the lattice.
So they plugged in the numbers. They measured the distance, they knew the speed. What did the model predict?
The model was pessimistic. It predicted that homogenization would be very, very slow. It suggested that even after long heat treatments, significant segregation would still remain.
But when they actually looked at the samples under the microscope, the reality was different.
Much different. The metal had homogenized much faster than the math predicted. The segregation disappeared way ahead of schedule.
Now, usually in science, reality is harsher than the model. Things usually go wrong. Why did things go right this time? Why did the atoms move faster than their speed limit?
This is a key insight from the paper. The simple formula assumes that each element is diffusing on its own. It assumes tungsten looks around, sees a concentration gradient, and just moves. It treats the elements as independent actors.
But this is a superalloy. It's a crowded dance floor. You have nickel, aluminum, titanium, tungsten, chromium, tantalum, all bumping into each other.
Exactly. The paper highlights inter-element flux effects, or cross terms. In a multi-component system like this, the movement of one element affects the others.
Inter-element flux. Can we break that down? How does one element help another one move?
Well, think of it like a slipstream, or maybe a vacuum. If a fast-moving element like aluminum rushes from that interdendritic space toward the core, it changes the local chemical environment. It changes the chemical potential. And that might create a stronger pull on the tungsten atoms to move in the opposite direction to balance things out.
So instead of walking alone, the aluminum is basically grabbing the tungsten by the hand and saying, hey, let's go.
In a sense, yes. The gradients of the fast elements can accelerate the slow elements. The simple math completely ignored this cooperative behavior. And Hillier and Bedicia suggest that these cross terms, specifically the interaction between the aluminum-titanium gradient and the tungsten, actually sped up the healing process.
That's a rare win for complexity. Usually adding variables just makes things harder. Here, the complexity of the alloy actually helped it homogenize itself.
It really underscores that you can't just treat a superalloy as a sum of its parts. You have to treat it as a complete system.
So we've navigated the heat treatment window. We've held the metal at 1300 degrees C for 32 hours or so. The dendrites are gone. The trees have vanished. Does that mean the metal is now perfectly uniform? Is it just a featureless gray block?
Macroscopically, yes. The large-scale casting segregation is gone. But microscopically, absolutely not. And we wouldn't want it to be.
Wait, I thought the whole point of homogenization was to make it uniform.
We want to erase the casting errors, the uncontrolled dendrites and those brittle eutectic blobs. But once that slate is wiped clean, the metal reorganizes itself. As it cools down or undergoes another aging treatment, the elements partition again, but this time in a very controlled, very deliberate way.
So they pick sides again.
They do. The paper details this partitioning of elements right in the conclusion. The alloy splits into two distinct phases that coexist perfectly.
So who goes where in the final lineup?
You have the gamma phase, that's gamma, and the gamma prime phase. The gamma prime phase is the precipitate. It grabs the aluminum, the titanium, and the tantalum.
And the gamma phase?
The gamma phase is the matrix. It's the glue that holds it all together. It keeps the chromium, the cobalt, and the tungsten.
So let me try to visualize this. We have a matrix of gamma, which is rich in that heavy tungsten. And floating inside it are these little particles of gamma prime.
Exactly. And in a high-performance blade, these gamma prime particles aren't just random blobs. They form tiny, ordered cubes, millions of them, all lined up in a perfect grid.
And that's what gives it the strength.
That is the secret sauce. Those cubes act as roadblocks. If the metal tries to stretch, if a dislocation tries to move through the crystal structure, it hits those gamma prime cubes and gets stuck. That is what creates the incredible creep resistance.
So to recap the journey of this material, we start with a liquid soup. It freezes into a messy, segregated forest of dendrites with brittle chunks at the edges.
A structure that would fail immediately in an engine.
Then we heat it up to a terrifyingly precise temperature squeezed between a rising floor and a falling ceiling to dissolve the bad chunks and let all the atoms mix.
Right, leveraging the inter-element flux to get it done faster than theory even predicts.
And finally, we let it cool and settle into this beautiful, ordered structure of gamma and gamma prime cubes that can survive inside a jet engine.
That is the life cycle. And this paper by Hillier and Bedicia was just crucial because it quantified the cost of that performance.
The cost being the difficulty of the manufacturing process.
Exactly. They proved that titanium is a double-edged sword. You want high titanium for those gamma prime cubes, for the strength, but if you add too much, you shrink the heat treatment window so much that you might not be able to manufacture the part reliably at all.
It gives the metallurgist the ammunition to say to the design engineer, look, I know you want 3% titanium, But if we do that, we'll melt half the blades in the furnace. We need to compromise at 2.5.
Precisely. It turns metallurgy from a kind of black art into a predictive science. It maps out the kill zone so you can avoid it.
It really changes your perspective on air travel. We often talk about precision engineering and we think about machining, you know, cutting metal to the right shape. But here, the precision is thermodynamic.
It is precision cooking on an industrial scale.
It's a recipe where a single decimal point difference in titanium content changes the entire physics of the oven.
And realizing that inside that solid, static-looking blade, there was this massive migration of atoms. You had tungsten moving one way, aluminum the other, all working to find their equilibrium. It's a very dynamic world at the atomic scale.
So the next time you're on a plane and you hear the engines roar to life, just think about the titanium atoms finding their way home into those tiny gamma prime cubes.
And the brave engineers who kept the furnace at 1300 degrees for 3 days straight just to make it happen.
Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into the heat treatment window. We'll see you next time.